surprising for me now just to hear that I've known Adam's Chido for about 15 years, having ambled along to Amaravati about 15 years ago. Amazing to think it's been that long. And I notice he's got less wrinkles and I've got a lot more. years. It's been a weird and wonderful path, really. Certainly far from finished. 15 years might seem like a long time. What am I now? 39 years old. I remember finishing my school years. 15 years was an interminable lifetime. Suddenly freed from the limitations of school, and now this last 15 years, a lot shorter. Reflecting, opportunity now to share a few reflections on Dhamma, my own experience in the practice, and hopefully it will be, might be of some benefit to those who are here tonight. Retreat time particularly offers a really wonderful opportunity for reflection. Affording, we have so much time to cultivate this practice and so much support. It's unbearable sometimes. All the good fortune to cultivate goodness, to cultivate the heart. And oftentimes what you have to sit with is absolutely excruciating, the opposite of what one would want or what one would expect sometimes. What we have to meet within ourselves in this path is extremely challenging. And sometimes we can see this with clarity and understanding, and sometimes not. Sometimes we're caught up in the whirlwind of it, and the dukkha of it. And in both times we can learn a lot when we're caught into it and when we have the clarity and perspective on that stuff, what we call our stuff. I was reflecting a little bit recently on there's different psychological models, that the model of the Buddha's world and the way he communicated the Dharma is very much a certain psychological model. And Mara was the deluder, that which had to be conquered within, Mara within, the deluder. And nowadays, I think it kind of clashes slightly with our psychological model, what we've been brought up with. Nowadays it's just our stuff, my emotional world, my grief, my rage, my despair, working out my stuff. But actually it's the same forces that we're working with. Very much the way the Buddha talked about dealing with Mara, the deluder. In different ways, actually. The whole path of training, of restraint, sila, samadhi, panya, restraint. But actually, ultimately, just to know Mara, to know all the forces of Mara, to know all the forces of the mind. Maya is another kind of old Indian word for mind, that which deludes. just to know it for what it is really the place of victory, when we can see our stuff just for what it is, rather than making it into a big me and my problem and stuff that I've got to work out and resolve and fix, get beyond, get rid of, what I'm lacking or what I've got obstructing me, all of this stuff. It's really just stuff of the mind, maya, that which comes to be, has causes and conditions for its existence. And this is the stuff of the world, the stuff that we learn from. Without it, without Mara, actually there's no awakening really, without this stuff, the grist for the mill. There's no real motivation to get beyond it. If we don't acknowledge suffering, if we aren't aware of suffering, then where is the energy to understand and go beyond it? So Mara is really the force that goads us towards awakening. And it's the same as our stuff, whatever we've got to work with. It's the stuff of awakening. If we can find the right relationship, how are we dealing with it? And this is the realm of the, once we undertake this practice, it can seem to take a long time just to get to know ourselves. As we start to look inwardly and get to know all the forces that are pushing and pulling us, get to know our own ways and means of being, of taking on the practice, the discipline, the vinaya and the meditation techniques, how we employ them, whether they're working or not working, and seeing our own tactics of mind in relationship to pleasure and pain, what we get stuck on, what we just want to get away from. All of this takes a long time just to get to know ourselves. And often, we pick up the practice with our own deluded views. And it can take a while to see that as well. Not that it's wrong, it's absolutely inevitable that that happens. We pick things up according to the way we see them, and we put them into practice. And then we learn from, is it working or not working? What are the results of the way I'm practicing? And this is a really hard learning experience, or at least in my experience. Because at first there's really an intellectual appreciation of Dhamma, where everything suddenly makes sense. Aha, the map's clear. There it is, it's all laid out. How wonderful, someone understood all this and presented a path of practice. And here I am, the great good fortune to hear it and the opportunity to practice and be supported in it. And off you go. Inspiration, aspiration, wonderful teachers, wonderful support. And and I guess it depends on each of us, how long it takes to all fall apart. It might be a short time, it could be a couple of years, some it might be 10, 15 years, but eventually at some point it will all fall apart. And that's really I think that's really where the practice begins, actually, this is a funny example. Probably most of you here haven't seen The Matrix, the movie. But it just reminds me of the time in that movie where, you know, the hero of the movie who's been cultivated to conquer Mara, basically, in the end, his first chance at leaping off the skyscraper and trying to leap to the other building, you know, psyching himself up. He knows it's just mind power, you just need the mind power to do it. I can do it. And leap in the skyscraper, get to those, it's all in the mind. Okay, here we go. And he's so convinced he can do it, you know, he's passed a few tests already, and so off he goes, and mid-air is like, oh my God, and dives down and just splat on the ground. I thought, oh, I know that feeling. Oh, how painful. And it's like, yeah, okay. Now we have a clearer understanding of what we're working with. So, end part one, intellectual understanding complete. Part two, experiential understanding. This is a different realm. And a very interesting realm, because it's new territory that we start to experience when we work experientially. Yeah, we still have a degree of intellectual understanding, a little bit more wariness and caution about how to use that, and where it can guide us, how it can guide us, but there's an understanding that this is, you know, this is like the guiding star. It's not something to grasp, it's not something to become on that level. It's a guiding star, it can give us some direction, but actually we have to walk this path in our own experience, in the territory of our own hearts, of our own mind. And no one else has walked there before. The Buddha walked the territory of his heart and his mind, which was huge, so he was able to leave a teaching behind that was incredibly comprehensive and all-embracing and very helpful. Many different types of teachings directed for many different kinds of beings caught in different predicaments, so we can always find something helpful for each of us in his teachings, but actually we take that into the territory of our own hearts, and it's unknown territory what we have to explore there and what we find there. And this is where we meet our deepest fears, those very powerful emotions, the raging worldly winds. And this is what we have to meet and find the skill, the tools, the supports to meet those things in our own practice, in our own lives, to deal with them skillfully in a way that leads to understanding and release rather than more complication and dukkha. And that is only learnt through our own experience. And in my experience, I seem to be learning from getting it wrong, going up this track. That's the wrong way. Go up this track. That's the wrong way. Or as Ajahn Chah responded once when someone suggested that he was contradicting himself quite often. And he said, you know, if I see someone coming towards me and they're veering off to the left, I say, go right, go right. If someone's coming, they're veering off to the right, I say, go left, go left. You know, there's no right way. That's certainly my experience in finding what the middle way is. It's like finding yourself in a ditch on the right outside, and you pick yourself up and waddle over to the left, and find yourself in the ditch on the left and pick yourself up. Or it can be a little bit more quickly, you know, more fast. You're just kind of getting slapped on both sides. You kind of find the middle, okay, stay on course for a while. It's a bit like that. But you know when you find the middle, there's a resting, there's a clarity, there's an understanding, there's a stillness, so from a very intuitive level, whether it's just momentary in your meditation, or whether it's a result of having worked with some difficult stuff and you finally seem to be getting through to the other side, or you've had some kind of insight into it and you can just be with it the way it is, and suddenly it eases out and it's okay. And it kind of disappears. You know, that's where you find the middle way. And so the more one finds that position, if we can call it a position, it's really a way of being. It's not a static thing. It's a living, responsive, sensitive way of being that is the middle way. But you recognize that intuitively, and something in you learns, grows in confidence in the experience of that. And gradually, as we go along the path and we meet the difficulties, we gain a little bit more experience of how to deal with this stuff that leads to that sense of release and ease, rather than more and more dukkha. But even, you know, even saying that much, it's easy to grasp the wrong end of the words or the view, you know, that, oh, if something results in ease, then that's the right way. If I'm experiencing pain, then that's the wrong way. And that is definitely not so. And that can actually, that in particular view, is something that we can get caught in a lot, because of the nature of the experience of pain. There's a fundamental kind of view within our psyche that says this is wrong, this shouldn't be, it's too painful, something's wrong, I'm wrong, or I'm bad, or something's not working. We have a lot of judgments. Can be quite obvious, or it can be just very subtle views about pain as we experience it. And the nature, our human nature, or the nature of any being, is to move away from pain, to contract, to shrink away, to get away from pain. So as long as we're not waking up to that conditioned activity, we're actually moving away from our opportunity for awakening. This is what I've at least understood in my own ways and tactics. That really recognizing where pain is and then turning to face it, and doing what you can to increase your capacity to be with it, to understand it, is the way to its cessation, not a moving away from it out of reactivity. So in my own practice, I've investigated that a lot, and what it takes to actually be with painful stuff. Because just in turning to face the pain, we experience a lot of other stuff in reaction to it. Like fear can come up very powerfully. Or rage, anger, you know, and can we even be with that stuff? Even before we get to touch into the pain, to really feel into it, we meet these kind of other barriers, you know, more of Mara's kind of screens, really, trying to deflect us from something. So practice has been increasing the capacity of awareness to settle around that which is uncomfortable or painful, and finding ways to ease into that, to be with that. And this is, for me, this is really only where you can learn from experience, because if I take the teachings that I hear or some of the teachings that I can read in the suttas and try to apply it, it doesn't necessarily work. You know, like how to dispel the hindrances. How to employ restraint with sense desire. Sometimes just something in my makeup seems to take these dictates. The tyrant picks up these dictates and tries to enforce them and creates more suffering. So I have found that it's much more an open-hearted approach that works. And so if just for example, if desire is present, instead of, well, first of all, listening to all the judgments that may arise, so desire, wrong, restraint, do something about this, and noticing that, you know, if I'm picking up that in the wrong way, it's increasing a sense of struggle or tension, which doesn't lead to the ending of suffering there. But if I can catch what's going on, and presently my way of working is, say, just give this space. Whatever's present here, just give it some space. And somehow there's a kind of a stretching of the space. No judgment. This is just what's present. And somehow just giving it the space, there's no struggle involved in that. It settles down. The energy of that particular hindrance or emotion starts to wind out by itself. And of course, the intensity of some of these things are such that you're caught into it before you can recognize what's going on, and then it's a matter of trying to remember how to be with it in terms of giving it space. So often, just the natural way is we get caught up in a struggle, usually because it's painful at some level. Not painful in itself, whatever's manifesting, it's a hindrance or emotion. But then the judgment and the struggle that ensues is double pain, extra pain. The desire to get rid of, or the desire to fix it, desire to get away from pain, whatever it is. So moving in the territory of your own heart into those places that actually haven't seen the light before. In psychological terms, we might call it our own shadow places, or in Buddhist psychology, as I said before, kind of doing battle with Mara, or meeting Mara, meeting the various temptations. It is new territory, and often we just don't know where it's going. Obviously the benefit of having community, teacher, the schedule of the monastery, it's also helpful just to give some kind of container for the work that one's doing, because one can find oneself in some very vulnerable spaces, some very unsure spaces, when our old views of ourselves and things start falling apart. And you're just not really sure what's going on anymore, either internally or externally. that holding environment then of the monastery, the teacher teaching, it's very, very helpful. And your own commitment actually to the practice. Just to hold you in a certain way, a wholesome way. To allow that work to continue. Because the tendency is that our need for security is so strong that we keep wanting to find a position, to find who we are, to identify with this thing or that thing. It seems to me that's a major force in the mind, that searching force, that bhava tanha is always looking to be something. And basically out of this sense of insecurity at not being anything. And as we try to arrest that force of the bhava tanha, which is what the practice, much of the practice is about, kind of easing that up, not going into new births, not being, not having the same channels of taking birth anymore. It's kind of restraint and the boundaries. So we have to start to get familiar with that very uncomfortable place of not quite being anything at all, or not quite knowing what's going on. It's very uncomfortable, but actually it's a very potent place to practice. But you can see the mind in all its desperation, really. The searching for security or affirmation or approval. Needing something concrete, something firm, something to identify with. That's just the force of the mind, the force of bhava tanha. That's there, and that's what we have to learn from, how it's always leading us into new births, new positions, new views of ourselves and others in the world. And when they do, we experience what that is, and we experience that breaking apart again. It's like this life. Some people seem to think that the monastic life is very ordered and very controlled. In my experience, it introduces the chaotic element. It's a paradox, really. On the outside, it's controlled and ordered, but actually, it's incredibly chaotic. Internally and just in a way of life, you're never quite sure what's going to happen or who's in control or who's steering the ship or who's bringing the food or if you're going to eat or all these kind of elements. And then you just watch the tendency in the mind to really need to control, to want to control, that sense of needing security. We start to investigate the true nature of our experience. What is it in its true nature? Buddha's pointing out all the time that, if we could just recognize the true nature of phenomena, actually that's what leads to freedom. To recognize the impermanent nature of all that arises. Whether they're ephemeral thoughts and feelings, or whether they're more long-term established views, or whether they're, this body made up of the elements that we have for a lifetime. It's all impermanent and changing continually. And this is an opportunity to see that as the reality. That's the way it is. And then see our own insecurity and fear around acknowledging that, around seeing that. You said it was the recognition or realization or understanding of impermanence that actually leads to liberation. And the first dharma it can give rise to is what's called nibbida, which is translated in various ways. I prefer disenchantment. It's translated as revulsion or disgust, which is, you know, has its own powerful meanings in the West. But I prefer a kind of disenchantment or weariness. Weariness is a bit soft, but disenchantment implies that we're losing our fascination with that which is we now see is impermanent. Whereas before, we didn't understand what impermanence was about, we're continually trying to gain some sense of foothold or security in the ephemeral world. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, sense impressions. We're trying to find security where there is no security. We're trying to find self, soul, being, in a place that is inherently insecure, changing. It's not where you're going to find security. The Buddha called Nibbana, he talked of Nibbana as a secure place, a refuge. But Nibbana is the result of understanding, seeing impermanence, becoming disenchanted with the world that's continually changing. The world of sense impressions, the world of mentality, materiality. Just seeing the nature of that, you know, we don't have to arouse disgust or disenchantment, just if we see clearly its own nature, nibbida arises. You can no longer be fascinated with something that you know will not please you, you know will not satisfy you. It's just a waste of energy. You know, I think a lot of the monastic life is just slowly learning that it's a waste of energy to chase after this illusory, ephemeral world of the mind. Various mental fabrications, what we create out of our sense experience. Just really looking very soberly at that and seeing the impermanent nature. All that arises and ceases. All that arises, ceases. It can be no other way. And so that leads one to a sense of disenchantment or weariness. And the result of that weariness, the Buddha said, was dispassion. That basic desire for being is cut off. That's a tricky phrase, isn't it? Desire for being. Desire for being that which is ephemeral. Desire for taking birth in an ever-changing world. The result of dispassion is liberation. What is it that's liberated? He talks of liberation of the mind. The mind in the suttas, various words are used for the mind, mano, citta, vijnana, and not always consistently. So that again, this is where in your own practice, in your own experience, you have to understand what is it that's liberated? What is it that arises and ceases? What is it that's liberated? What is liberation? So in your own experience, when you're letting go, when you let go of something that you see is impermanent, or the mind just moves away from something, the result of that, the ease or stillness, when the mind sees something arise and pass away, What is it that's not caught up in that? The Buddha talked about something called non-manifestive consciousness, or consciousness that no longer gives rise to formations, no longer concocts the world. This is the mind that comes to stillness or cessation, the cessation of the world, the cessation of suffering. The mind that is liberated understands that cessation. It's not an annihilation. It's more a realization of that which always was ephemeral, and a letting go of that, and abiding in the nature of a mind that is no longer caught up. So that's the direction, that's something that we can experience, say, momentarily in our practice, and that can inform us of how to continue with the practice, how to continue cultivating. But I've always found that there are always more challenges, there are always more to learn that I didn't understand. And often I realize it's a breaking down of views. What can happen in the practice once something works, and then somehow we establish some kind of view. And if we hang on to that view, okay, this is the way it is, this is the way it should be, this is the way I practice. Sooner or later we're going to meet the limitations of that, and that's going to fall apart, and we're going to find ourselves again in unknown territory, meeting new things. And part of that process as well for myself is, you know, coming to the edge of those views is also coming to the edge of myself, and having those views fall apart is also the experience of having myself fall apart, or almost a sense of dying sometimes, when you meet the limitations of who you thought you were. You know, when you meet your fears of your own failure, of your own expectations of yourself, that you have, or that you've had, you just can't live up to. You just can't meet that image of what you're supposed to be. And what happens there is very, very powerful. And in my own practice, they're the points of the most incredible kind of pain, actually. And the kind of effort it takes to stay with that process, and the learning that can happen there is very powerful. Finding new capacities just to be with the unknown, to be with the painful. Your capacity to acknowledge the depth of your own hatred of pain, your own strength of rebellion and resistance. You can hold that as well, be present with that. It's very humiliating process, really. Remember one Zen teacher, Charlotte Joker Beck in America, she said, the path to enlightenment is one humiliation after another. And it gave me some confidence. It's like that falling off a building experience. Okay, this is part of the path. On the right track. It's true. I coined my own term as a result of a certain period of experience called humilification. It's like purification through humiliation, when you really do feel like a total failure. And fortunately I had a good spiritual friend who advised me, said, great, just be a total failure. I thought, be a total failure, it's absolutely okay. That's interesting. Just meeting the fear, you know, that the pain of, oh my God, it's really not working. I've done my best and it's really not working. And meeting the fear and the resistance, and then what's the fear about? It's about being a failure, total failure. Oh, that's absolutely okay. Be a failure. Give it space. Give that feeling space. And what happens? Stop struggling and resisting and denying, and that feeling becomes very small and fades out. It's just like the Tibetan story of, I don't know, was it Milarepa or Marpa, one of those great tantric masters who comes back from arms around or something to their cave and find their cave's been taken over by devils or whatever, Mars. And they only get smaller with loving kindness, but the more kind of anger or resistance you have to them, they just feed on that and get bigger and stronger. And it's the same as the stuff that we find within. The stuff that we fear, the big monsters and the ghastly things that we can't bear to think of, oh my God, is that really me? Oh no, I always suspected it, but no, I'm going to have to admit it, you know. Can I? It's those kind of things that actually feed off our resistance and denial and struggle. And yet if we can give it space, just a feeling. Just another feeling. Poof. And that's it's quite a relief to see that. But it's amazing how many of these ghouls and monsters we have to meet, kind of enfolded within our psyche. But once you recognize how they can be. We can say that we can dispel them or we can accommodate them. It results in the same thing. Giving it space is like, to me, is like accommodating what's there. Compassionately accommodating doesn't mean giving, letting it have the reins. It's like compassionate accommodation of what is. I guess that takes a certain trust in the refuge, the capacity of heart that can just trust, ease out a bit, to know it for what it is. But as I said, I've found if I tell myself, give it space, and that gives me the capacity to let it be. Or sometimes a few years ago, just meeting some really difficult emotional pain, I just have to tell myself it's absolutely okay to feel miserable, because there are so many layers of judgment saying this is not okay, it's really not, something's really wrong, or projecting that wrongness onto someone else who's doing it to you, or the situation that's just not okay. if I got out of here, it would be all right. But actually giving yourself permission, it's absolutely okay to be feeling this feeling. You can start to, show up those layers of judgment that says it's not okay, wrong, get away, get rid of. That's basically the vibhava tanha energy that feeds it, keeps it there, keeps the struggle going. So, you don't find that kind of stuff actually in the suttas. The Buddha doesn't say it's absolutely okay to be angry. He says it's an unwholesome state, should be abandoned. So if we take that just on a literal level, what I've tended to do is say, judge it, unwholesome, wrong, we don't want that, get rid of it. Try and find a way to abandon it. Abandon it means, get rid of it. But that it kept sticking. So what does abandonment really mean? Kind of relinquishing it, how to let it go. Abandonment is the tanha, the craving, the lust or the delight in that thing. So if we have delight in anger, we think, how could we delight in anger? But we do, because it's something that I can be, at least. But the abandoning is always of that link, the craving that links us to the object, whether it's anger or desire. And the craving can be the wanting to be that or the not wanting to be that. It both connects us. Both ways connect us and feed the that particular state. So the abandonment refers to that craving or tanha, the aversion or desire. And abandonment doesn't happen through judgment, in my experience. Just to say it's wrong, I've got to get rid of it. For me, it's helped to see it also as impermanent conditioned phenomena. The desire to get rid of something arises upon feeling. Unpleasant feeling conditions the desire to get rid of. Feeling arises upon contact, sense contact. So just recognizing those conditioning factors, that tanha or craving is also just one link in the chain. Often we get caught into the idea that I am the one who craves, which is me. What I'm doing. It's so identified with that volitional activity that takes us into birth. But actually, we have to actually see that link as impermanent as well, impermanent and not self. It arises upon feeling. Pleasant feeling, I want. Unpleasant feeling, I don't want. It's just that much. So if you pay attention to the feeling that the craving arises upon, pleasant, unpleasant, pay attention to that. Is that feeling permanent? Is that feeling always been there? Did that feeling arise from somewhere? Start to investigate around that. I've found that as being more of a fruitful approach to abandoning craving than the idea that I should get rid of this or that I have to abandon this. Abandoning happens through, as I said before, there's that link between impermanence. Seeing something clearly to be impermanent, you lose your enchantment with it. Disenchantment leads to dispassion, which is the breaking of the link. Seeing something as not self breaks the link. Seeing something as suffering also breaks the link. These three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta, can break that link of craving. Getting caught up in the self-view very subtle, you know, like I've got to do this work, I've got to deal with this stuff, I've got a problem with this, and I've got to work this out, and I've got my ways to do it, and strategies and tactics and goals, whatever. You know, it might work for some people. But for myself, I work much better to just be present with what is, and noticing, as I was saying last night in the meditation, noticing origination, cessation, phenomena. Very important dharmas to acknowledge, to inform the mind of, because we're just so used to being something, existing, being with the activity of existing, we don't naturally notice the things, where they arise from, where they cease, how they arise, how they cease. The delusion is we are someone existing in time and space. I am this body, having been born however many years ago. Recently, I guess 6 months ago or something, quite struggling for quite some time with suffering, of course, and again just contemplating why I wasn't able to find that point of release. Something that occurred to me might be helpful for you, so I'll share that, because it made quite a difference in my practice at that point, was that I saw that I was assuming there was still this view that with painful feeling that I was inherently deluded because I was suffering with this painful feeling. And that somehow that was a problem. You know, if I wasn't deluded, this wouldn't be a problem. Now, I wasn't aware of this view. You know, it was just something that I suddenly saw as this very subtle take that my being deluded was a problem causing me suffering. And then there's something occurred to me that it was, you know, word this correctly. The delusion is not in the fact that there is painful feeling. The delusion is in the fact that you're taking that to be me and my problem. Me and mine. The painful feeling arises. Been caused. You can't stop it arising. It doesn't mean you're deluded. We're deluded as soon as we take it to be me and mine. And when I saw that, there was a shift. It was quite subtle, you know, when delusion was still creating a self-view that I'm suffering, I'm deluded, therefore I'm suffering, so delusion is the problem, how to get rid of it, basically, or how to wake up. But then saying, no, painful feeling is not the problem. There will be painful feeling. There will be suffering. The practice is not about getting rid of that. The practice is about waking up to the fact that it's not you. You don't have to pick it up and make it into a problem. It passes its own cord. Spends its energy. And then what occurred to me And not long after that, it was also something that was missing in my practice, which allowed that view of being deluded and it being my problem to continue somehow. And that was that I noticed that I was really suffering about my suffering. And the missing element was that I wasn't respecting my suffering. And as soon as somebody just said to me, you need to respect your suffering. And as soon as that element came in, there was a sense of wholeness and stillness and a strange sense of nobility that wasn't there before. Just with that much, you need to respect your suffering. Because part of that view of, if I'm suffering, it's because I'm deluded. There was a hatred in that, an aversion, a desire to get free of it. And it wasn't a noble acknowledgement of dukkha. It was the experience of dukkha that was degrading. And the Buddha talks about the noble truths. The first noble truth is that of suffering. There is suffering. It's a noble truth. But he also talks about other forms of suffering that are ignoble. And it was really only at that point that I recognized something a little bit more significant about that. To make your suffering noble, you have to see it in a way that actually you respect it as something that can lead you to awakening, the first noble truth. With that respect, you have a sense of wholeness and integrity about what you're doing, about what you're experiencing, whether it's pleasure or pain. And with that integrity, you have the capacity to meet it. If we're ripping ourselves apart and trying to meet suffering, we don't have the integrity or capacity or strength. So that for me, it was that thing about respect. You're not respecting your suffering. I was flagellating myself over it. You're wrong. You've done something wrong to your suffering. It's not. So to make it into a noble truth, suffering is the path. How to respect ourselves, and respect our suffering. Respect ourselves for being with our suffering and working with it. And then, as I said, you have the capacity of mind, the clarity, the stillness, the integrity, then to see much more clearly around what's happening. No longer struggling with ourselves and defeating ourselves. So I don't think it's insignificant that the whole of the Buddha's teaching is based on the teaching around suffering, the Four Noble Truths. He summed up himself and asked what he teaches. I just teach suffering and the end of suffering. So inevitably our path is going to be about suffering. So how to make it into a noble truth. Very important. I'll stop there for this evening, and I'm going into a more solitary mode tomorrow. So I hope some of what I've shared tonight is of benefit to some of you, and I wish everyone a very fruitful 2 months of retreat to follow. And also express my thanks and gratitude for everyone's practice, everyone's effort, and for being welcomed into the community to be here for this time. And for the Sita, for the teachings and support. Thank you. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.